Hello and welcome to Lexitecture, a podcast about word origins and histories. My name is Ryan, and in each episode, my friend Amy and I bring a new pair of words to share their stories with each other and you. You can find our past episodes and the occasional blog post on our website at lexitecture.com. Follow along with us on Twitter and Facebook at Lexitecture. And if you really like what we do, you can support the show at patreon.com/lexitecture. Today's episode, January Vaccine.
Let's do some cathartic wording.
Oh, wait, we have...
We have business to attend to.
Yes, so we have two new Patreon supporters.
Yay!
Already in January.
We love those guys.
We love those guys. So I generally send out emails, like messages of thanks, and just sort of trying to clear names and whatnot for shout-outs of thanks. I haven't heard back, so I'm just going to use either first names or display names. So there's first up, there was Jen, who signed up on New Year's Day, starting off 2021 with a bang. And then someone whose Patreon name is Besk, B-E-S-C. So you know who you are, presumably. So Besk and Jen, thank you so much for signing up.
Thank you so much.
That's fantastic. For the rest of you, patreon.com/lexitecture, hashtag always be plugging. And you can find out what all the fuss is about and support the show. But yeah, thanks to them and all our Patreon sponsors and warm fuzzies all around.
Yeah, I know I say some variation of this every single time, but we are so incredibly grateful that you choose not only to put us in your ears, but also to support our ability to be in your ears. Yeah, we're kind of amazed that happens and very, very
it's
grateful.
Weird. But yes, so cathartic wording.
So, yeah. Many
yes,
thanks.
Thank you.
Cathartic wording. Okay, do you want me to go first?
I want you to go first.
So this is an interesting one because in the spirit of our incredibly well planned months in advance programming, I was scrambling about to find a word, and I was having that sort of, you know, when you kind of half research something and then you get sick of it or you decide that it's not any good for whatever reason, and I had a few like that were going on, and I was just kind of stuck.
Right.
And the lockdown thing is, I think, really contributes to my stuckness in lots of ways, not just for this podcast. So I'd gone out for a walk with my husband this afternoon, and he said, "What word are you going to talk about?" And I said, I actually don't know yet. And then he made a suggestion, and I knew what the etymology of the word was, which is unusual. Usually my words come from my, I wonder where this word comes from kind of affair. But this one, I was actually, you know, I was aware of it already. And I've actually thought about talking about this word before, but have assumed that, well, everybody knows the etymology of this word, so that would be a waste of everybody's time.
Right.
And then I thought, well, first of all, does everybody know the etymology of this word? Is it fair for me to assume that that is the case? Also, I figured that the worst that could happen is that either listeners don't know the etymology of the word, in which case they learn something, which is nice, or they already do, in which case they get the sort of warm, fuzzy, self-congratulatory feeling of going, I already knew that.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So I figured that either way it was you know, worth my time. The word is vaccine.
Ooh. I do not know this, so I'm in that lump of listeners.
Yeah, so this was going to be my first question. I was going to say to you, are you aware of the etymology of this word? And obviously you're not. That's good.
No, I'm not.
Cools. So when my husband said to me, why don't you use vaccine? I said, do you know the etymology? Do you know where this word comes from? And he looked at me as if I was crazy, as if to say, you know that sort of stuff. I don't care. And and I explained to him what I knew about it. And along the way of that explanation, as very often happens to me, I don't know if it happens to other people, you know that way when you know something really well and then you start to talk about it and then you immediately doubt every single word that you say?
Absolutely.
But the word vaccine has its roots in the Latin word vacca, V-A-C-C-A, which means, do you know this word? If you're a French speaker, you might have an idea. It means cow.
Oh, yes. Okay, it's all coming back to me. I love it. So, yes, cow.
Yeah, so people have this reaction. You know, this is what I mean about this. I think it's a fairly commonly known etymology. But I find it really interesting. Firstly, because there are people who don't know that, and they make that noise when they do, because what people tend to know about vaccination, the sort of QI guide to it, if you like, klaxons at the ready, is that British doctor Edward Jenner invented vaccination by noticing that milkmaids didn't get smallpox.
Yes.
And...
yeah, okay.
This is almost all of that story, almost everything that I said there is untrue. He did notice that milkmaids didn't get smallpox, but Edward Jenner did not invent vaccination. He was not even the first person to have thought about vaccination for smallpox, but as is often the case with science, I found a really interesting scientific paper called Edward Jenner and the History of Smallpox and Vaccination, which starts off with a quotation from Francis Galton, the notable scientist, that says, "In science, credit goes to the man who convinces the world, not the man to whom the idea first occurs." And right. I think this is a really, really salient point that's made here at the start of this. And the paper starts off with a short introduction about smallpox, but it says, "Edward Jenner is well known around the world for his innovative contribution to immunisation and the ultimate eradication of smallpox. Jenner's work is widely regarded as the foundation of immunology, despite the fact that he was neither the first to suggest that infection with cowpox conferred specific immunity to smallpox, nor the first to attempt cowpox inoculation for this purpose." So it really is a very much a... he must have had a great agent. That's all I can think of. He obviously was just a good marketing guy. Now, I'm sure I said to you last time that I'd been reading the very, very wonderful The Body by Bill Bryson.
Yes.
And I've finished it now. It was such good fun, as Bill Bryson books always are. It's like sitting down in a pub with somebody you know well and like a lot who tells wonderful stories. That's kind of my take on Bill Bryson books. And he writes about Jenner, and here I am riffling to find the page. It's interesting to consider a disease like smallpox when you're in the midst of a global pandemic, because smallpox, interestingly, Bill Bryson writes about the fact that one of the things that everybody knows about smallpox is that it's been eradicated. It's actually not true. So here's what Bryson has to say about this. I hope he doesn't listen and sue. I'd really love it if he listened, but I'm just going to read a small excerpt from his book.
Okay.
"Smallpox is almost certainly the most devastating disease in the history of mankind. It infected nearly everyone who was exposed to it and killed about 30% of its victims. The death toll in the 20th century alone is thought to have been around 500 million. Smallpox's astounding infectiousness was vividly demonstrated in Germany in 1970 after a youthful tourist developed it upon returning home from a trip to Pakistan. He was placed in hospital quarantine, but opened his window one day to sneak a cigarette. This, it has been reported, was enough to infect 17 others, some two floors away."
Jeez.
Yeah, it's pretty horrific. And the notion that it's gone, that it's been eradicated, it's been eradicated in the sense that it no longer spreads through the population. It's no longer out there. But there are two stocks of smallpox that remain in the world. Again, this is from Bill Bryson's book. "In government freezers at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, and at a Russian virology institute near Novosibirsk in Siberia. Both countries have several times promised to destroy the remaining stocks, but never have."
Oh, I don't like that.
I don't like that either. I definitely don't like it, like, now, this year, in the sort of time that we're living through. Like, you know, let's just pretend that it doesn't exist anymore.
Agreed.
So, smallpox, just to clear up the cow connection, smallpox is a disease. Variola is the variation. And variola is the Latin name for smallpox. And Jenner noticed, let's go back to Jenner, even though we know he wasn't the first person to do it, but basically he realised that giving someone a mild case of cowpox, a disease that milkmaids often got from their exposure to cattle, meant that you were immune to smallpox.
Right.
And smallpox was, I mean, it was incredibly deadly. It also horribly scarred people who survived. And it was, you know, it was rife. It was so very infectious, it infected everybody. So Jenner realised that by inoculating, this is another interesting word, by inoculating people with cowpox, he would render them immune to smallpox. And so vaccination was born. Now, if you look at the OED's history of the word, if you look at the when this was happening, it's quite interesting, actually, because I did a kind of quick search and I got three results from my quick search. And the first one, it says, is obsolete, and that's vaccine noun. And I thought that's a bit odd because that's, you know, we use the word vaccine now. However, this word meant vaccination. So the word vaccine was used as vaccination. And the citation that's given here from 1803 says, it is to them the world owes inoculation, which they so long opposed, or the vaccine, which they still oppose. So the process of being vaccinated was called vaccine. We're also given in the OED entry for this particular one, vaccine matter used in vaccination, so that the stuff that is given to you, which is, I think, you know, the way that we use it now. This is given from 1846. And then more generally, a preparation of the causative organism or substance of a disease or its product that has been specifically treated for use in vaccination. And that's from 1882. The adjective vaccine we see from 1799. And the adjective vaccine at that time was being used for cowpox. So we have from Medical and Physical Journal, the certainty that the having suffered the vaccine disease will prove a preservative from the infection of the smallpox. So when Jenner and others talked about the vaccine disease, they meant the cow disease. And so the other meaning we have here is appearing in or characteristic of the disease of cowpox. So you might talk about matter taken from a vaccine pustule. But again, this is purely all about the cows. Vaccines relating to the cows, all about the cowpox.
That's really interesting because I was trying to think of what word of that same format, but I hadn't arrived at the words used to describe things that share characteristics with animals, like bovine or equine or vaccine. Or vaccine.
Well, I found it very interesting because when I'd said to my husband, when he said vaccine, I said, oh, from vaxa, Latin for. And then I said, do you know what it's the Latin for? You'll never guess. And he started to guess. He guessed various things. And I said, it's cow. And he said, oh, of course, because vache in French means cow, which I wasn't aware of. And I had said, oh, I was assuming that because bovine is the adjective meaning cow-like.
Yeah.
I had assumed that bova was the Latin word for cow. You know, that was, I generally thought that was the case.
Yeah.
I found a lovely website called mashedradish.com, which it's mashed radish everyday etymology, and they actually have an entry about the word vaccine too. And one of the things that I really liked about this, it mentioned that it says you may quickly recognise the Spanish for cow, vaca and vaquero, vaquero meaning a cowboy or a herdsman. And vaquero, interestingly, was anglicised to become the word buckaroo.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of fun.
That's nice.
Beyond Latin, I couldn't get much earlier than that. There was no pie root associated with vaca on Etym Online. Mastradis traced it to a pie root, woke it, Wokeh. There was some dispute over that in the pie dictionary that I looked at, and in the Latin etymological dictionary that I looked at, that the pie root seems to, there are some problems to do with vowel shifts that mean that no one seems quite convinced that there's a clear path to a single pie root. But interestingly, one of the theories that leads us to this particular pie root that Mastradis talk about is that vaca is cognate with the Sanskrit word vasa, which also means cow. So, there's hints of pie, but no actual pie. But yeah, huh. I did enjoy buckaroo. That was quite a nice thing.
Buckaroo is a lot of fun.
Interestingly, another word for vaccination, variolation, and variolation was very much about smallpox, comes from the variola, as I said, the Latin name for smallpox. And variolation was to specifically be vaccinated against cowpox. Against smallpox. The OED also makes the point that it was Louis Pasteur who was the first person to use the term vaccine more generally to mean give someone one disease to prevent another.
Right.
But until that point, as we see in the etymology of the adjective vaccine, relating to cows, or specifically relating to cowpox, until that point, it meant vaccine was always to do with smallpox, because you had, you had that very clear linguistic root. The OED also has an entry for vaccine, the verb. There's only one citation from 1804. It says, "Tomorrow, I think we had better have him vaccinated." So I quite like that vaccined came before vaccination did. Also, another thing to point out, it's, you know, there's a very clear reason why I'm talking about the word vaccine right now at this time and in this space. It's very, very cool that vaccines can be created as quickly as the vaccines against COVID have been created.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I know that that's something that's also making people feel a little bit nervous. Personally, right now, I would take that vaccine in the eye.
Yeah, 100%.
That is, you know, I understand that people may feel differently, but yep, in the eye or worse places. If they were to say to me, have these jabs and then you can go about your business again without having to worry about this, yeah, stab me multiple times. That's very much how I feel. But, you know, people have reservations about these vaccines, and, you know, people have reservations about all kinds of vaccines. I thought it was worth pointing out that when Edward Jenner popularised this method of stopping people from getting smallpox, which I'm just going to remind you again, which was a disease that infected everybody that came into contact with it and had a 30% mortality rate.
Yeah, that's nuts.
People were still against vaccination, even at that time. So, yeah, anti-vaxxing actually has a long and varied history, starting with Jenner. There were people saying, you can't give us this, we won't take it. And public health vaccination programs take that into account. So, for example, it's been very well researched and proven that making vaccines compulsory is in fact counterproductive.
Mm.
So if right now the British government were to say we have a billion stocks of this vaccine, which is certainly not the case. But if they were saying we have enough for everybody to have it and we have the capacity to give everybody it in the next week, and so we've decided that you all have to come and get a vaccine, this would actually lead to fewer people being vaccinated than if you offer it freely.
Right, yeah.
Which just goes to show what crazy, contrary creatures human beings are. Yeah. Yes, vaccine.
Basically.
We're all
cows. That's very cool. All a bunch of cows. That's neat. I also like how you pronounce vaccine differently.
Oh, you say vaccine and I say vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had not know. I was not aware of an alternative pronunciation to the one that I use, which is sort of like saying at the beginning, I know this, so I assume everybody else knows it. It's not a good assumption to make. It's not certainly not a place of scientific inquiry. You can't come at scientific inquiry from that place.
Yeah, saying everyone. Yeah, I was gonna bring up because my word is similar in that I suspect a lot of people know the basic etymology of it, but. Are you familiar with the webcomic XKCD?
Yes.
So there's one, Randall's got one, there's one of these forever. It's like the new incarnation of the Far Side where there's like an applicable comic for just about any situation.
I think I've seen the comic that you're about to tell me about. Sent it to me. I probably saw it via you.
For but everything. Continue. Yeah, he basically says, for everything that, quote, everybody knows by age, let's say 30, that means that, you know, he does all the math and works out the averages and how long it takes people to find these things out. And basically says, like, I can't remember the number, but I think it's like 12,000. But he's like, for everything that, quote, everybody knows by age 30 or 35, there's probably like 12,000 people a day learning that thing for the first time.
Yeah, that's super cool. I love that.
And so he, in the comic, the one stick figure runs into another stick figure who doesn't. And instead of being like, you don't know this, everyone knows this, he's like, yes, you're part of today's 12,000 or whatever the number is. And so, yeah, that just made me think of that. It also made me feel better that you have a word that you suspect lots of people know, because that's my word as well.
I should also point out, just in the spirit of people being terrible, I'm going to do a little bit of, you know, it's not fair to call this Canadian bashing because he was super duper British and commander in chief of the British Army. But when I was reading about smallpox, I read about Geoffrey Amherst. As a Canadian, okay. Do you know anything about Geoffrey Amherst?
I don't believe I've ever heard that name before.
Ah, so this is interesting. So this just comes from the Wikipedia entry for Geoffrey Amherst, 1st Baron Amherst. And I saw his name in that paper that I mentioned earlier, looking at the history of gender and smallpox vaccination. But he's most noted. So Wikipedia states that he was an officer and commander-in-chief of the forces in the British Army, best known as the architect of Britain's successful campaign to conquer the territory of New France during the Seven Years' War. Under his command, the British forces captured the cities of Louisbourg, Quebec City and Montreal, as well as several major fortresses. He was also the first British Governor General in the territories that eventually became Canada. Numerous places and streets are named for him in both Canada and the United States. This has gotten to be somewhat problematic, however, because you know how sometimes things get named after people who were massive dickwads?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Often, in fact.
What's that all about? I saw, as I was walking past the local newsagents today, I saw a headline, you know, like headline poster saying that stars have called for a statue of Billy Connolly to be erected. And I joked to my husband, just before we do that, can we just double check, has Billy Connolly ever been a slave owner? I feel like that's the sort of thing that we should know first.
There should be a checklist, yeah.
It's going to cause a whole lot less trouble later on. Like, further down the line, this could be problematic. But here is Amherst's legacy. It's controversial, as Wikipedia says, due to his expressed desire to exterminate the race of indigenous people during Pontiac's war and his advocacy of biological warfare in the form of gifting blankets infected with smallpox as a weapon, notably at the siege of Fort Pitt. He's that guy.
He's the guy.
He's the smallpox blankets guy. And I feel like the smallpox blankets thing is sort of it's like a terrible thing that people know about the treatment of Indigenous peoples. But this is the specific, it's the first time that the first known use of, or certainly recorded use of biological warfare. And it was smallpox that was used. So it's interesting because it states, you know, in 2019, the city of Montreal removed his name from a street in the city. renaming it Rue Atatiken from the Mohawk language. The town of Amherst, Nova Scotia, is also considering renaming in light of recent movements to reconsider the naming of, quote, towns, streets and monuments that celebrate past war heroes whom, seen through today's ethical lens, are not people who behaved in ways that we respect today. So, there's Amherst all over North America.
Yeah.
The town in Massachusetts with the university, for example.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's that guy. So...
Jeez.
Yeah.
Hooray.
Turns out smallpox isn't that fun. Thank God for cows and vaccination.
Yes, thank you, cows. You have given us so much.
So delicious much.
Yeah. Wow. That sucks. Stupid Amherst. Also, Amherst just makes me the only thing. This is my knowledge of history. Also, Canadians are really good at specifically and pointedly and stubbornly ignoring those bits of our history where they would weaken our position of feigned superiority over the Americans for their racial problems. So it's not surprising that I don't know about Amherst, and that the only connection to Amherst that my brain made was the line that Mr. Butlertron says in Clone High, where he goes, he's been that way since Amherst. And it's, yeah. And again, see, it's nice when these lines keep getting retrodden, because here's Amy with an important historical fact about a pivotal moment in North American history. And then here's me going, hey, that's that line from Clone High.
Listen, man, I don't care where people get their knowledge in their history from. You know, it's
true. Most people know classical music from Looney Tunes, at least in our generation.
Exactly.
So, which is as good a place as any, or better.
I feel this. You know, I have strong feelings about this kind of notion when it comes to reading, because, you know, I'm a person who loves to read. I'm an English teacher. I have a degree in English. I teach children to hopefully enjoy reading books. But people get so caught up in not reading the right things, or guilty pleasures of reading, or I read but only this kind of book. It's like, who gives a damn? Reading's amazing. Yeah. So do it the way that you enjoy doing it. Somebody else telling you that you're only a reader if you read X, Y, or Z, quite frankly, can fuck off.
Yeah.
So,
basically.
Yeah, learning's learning, and enjoying words is enjoying words. Nobody else gets to tell us how we do that.
It's true.
So there.
Yeah, yeah. So my word that lots of people probably know and is very simple and is very straightforward, this is me building up expectations super high really early.
Yeah, I see that, yeah.
Is January.
Oh, and interesting.
I like January. Because A, it's simple, and B, because there was lots of little offshoots. So this is like, this is one of those things where there's more tangents than actual, like, core elements to this.
I'm sorry, Ryan, I cannot possibly allow that to be the case. You know what a stickler I am for.
I know.
Focusing on the words.
It's going to drive you nuts, but we're going to have a lot of tangents here, so buckle up.
I lift the tangents.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's lots of interesting things. So, first off, January, the word January, doesn't show up in English until about the 13th century, for the most part. Now, it was a confusing OED entry to look at, because there were, well, actually, the early 14th century, actually, in writing, there were two old English sources in the OED for the use of the word January. But weirdly, it was like it was two old English sources, and then it was the 13 and 1400s, and nothing in between.
Right, okay.
Which always makes me kind of go, wait, hang on. And so normally at that point, what I would do is then try to look up what those sources were and see if I could dig them up and read to find out something. Because they were both sources where it's like, an old English text is being cited in an early 20th century book.
Right, okay.
And it's in that context that the word January shows up. And so my first thought is, were the editors of the 1929 book that I'm actually looking at, like, were they just substituting the names of the months to make things a little more sort of in sync with their readers? Or, you know, like, so I'm not sure what that is, because my first thought is, well, January is from the, like, Latin and different calendar, and would they have used it in Old English and this, that, and the other thing?
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't sure. It didn't help that the original sources were both in German. So when I did find them, I couldn't read them anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I got that word, though. But it's, but then again, the Romans were in Britain, obviously, forever ago. And so it stands to reason that there would be possibly some already ancient by then Roman name that was sticking around that certain scholars writing in Old English would know about and would use. So that whole thing is a little muddy. But so technically the earliest sources in the OED are both Old English, but they have those asterisks beside them.
Sure.
And I don't really know what to make of that. After that, it's the very beginning of the 14th century, very end of the 13th century. We'll get the etymology out of the way. The name January comes from Janus, the Roman god of beginnings and transitions. He's depicted as having two faces facing in opposite directions. And he basically presided over sort of transition periods between war and peace and doorways, gates, passages, endings, beginnings, all that
all
kind
that
of
jazz.
Awesomeness. The first little interesting tidbit that made me look into this is I was looking up an article, a little snippet on Janus, and I learned that the Temple of Janus in Rome was only open during times of war. And if there was peace, the doors were shut and nobody could go in.
Oh, that's cool.
It was just closed in times of peace. Now, this is Roman Republic, Roman Empire. War was happening all the time. So it was usually open. It was like 20 minutes here and there when it was shut, and everyone got to go to sleep and have a little bit of a nap and maybe some lunch, and then it was open again because it was somewhere in the Roman Empire there was war happening.
Just think that the only person going, oh, God, war, not because of the humanitarian cost or the violence, just for the sheer inconvenience of it, was the chief priest of Janus going, yeah. Sigh.
Now I got to go sweep so we can open up again. Come on. Now, the name for this Roman god seems to have come from a Pi root, which is transliterated just as E-I, meaning to go.
Oh.
And gives us a whole list from the American Heritage Dictionary of cognates, including words like ambient, circuit, coitus, exit, issue, obituary, parish, sedition, transit, commence, initial, count, and constable.
My goodness, what a very disparate list.
It is a very disparate list, yeah. And so, and I mean, part of it is because just the simplicity of the root,
yeah,
both
sure.
in like sort of spelling-wise and meaning-wise, it just means to go. So anything that has anything to do with going will probably trace back to this root at
yeah,
some point.
It's pretty ubiquitous.
Yeah. But this kind of makes sense. The god of beginnings and transitions. Yes, first month of the year, there's natural transition point. That all makes a certain amount of sense.
This is funny because earlier on today, on the same walk with my husband, we passed a sign outside a supermarket that was it was encouraging people to have a meat-free January. You know, this is a thing people call it veganuary or whatever. And in the case of the supermarket, they have, you know, they're marketing plant-based foods and ready meals and packaged things and whatever, you know, as they do.
Right.
And I said, I don't get it. I mean, all these like dry January and meat-free January and, you know, people depriving themselves of things for a month. Of all the months to do it in,
yeah.
Why would you do it in January? It is objectively the shittiest month of the year.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, I feel like I feel like I hate February more, but they're kind of lumped in, which is interesting because that brings me to this next thing, which is another thing that I feel like lots of people know, but maybe it's just because I'm a huge nerd. But this is that whole thing where why are the last 4 months of our calendar named wrong?
Yes. I'm really glad that you're going to explain this because I feel like I've read this before or somebody's told me it before, but I never, ever actually remember what the jam is.
Yeah. So the idea is, for those who who don't know, is that September, October, November, December are named for the Latin words for the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th month. So, like octopus, you know, nonagon, sure, whatever those other things are, decathlon. So, but they are, in fact, the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th month, of course. So they're off by 2 months, which is weird. And it is because in the early days of the Roman calendar, and we're talking like, it's ambiguous because it's all very muddy when you get back this far, but several hundred years, sure, like 600 years-ish BC, mm-hmm, they just didn't bother with January and February. They didn't bother with the winter months. They're like, here are the months, and then there's that garbage time.
Oh, I can totally get behind this.
Everyone can get behind it, right? January and February, this long drudgery, everything's stupid and miserable.
Fuck those guys, they're not even getting a name.
Exactly. We don't care about that. You just sort of get through it, and then we get to the real, the actual year starts.
This sort of feels like a very, very appropriate thing, given 2020.
Yeah. This muddy, yeah, there's this muddy,
I mean,
time.
I don't know, like, quite a lot of the year was that muddy,
well,
fuck
that's
you
exactly
time.
Yeah, 2020 was the year that is just nothing but February. It sucked. So that was the thing. They only had 10 months, and then they had this sort of middle bleak winter time that was just sort of going through. The Roman ruler Numa Pompilius is generally credited as being the dude what added January to the calendar, January and February.
Cool.
And originally, January was at the beginning, and February was at the end of the calendar. And then the date that I keep seeing is about 452 BC. That's when February, somebody just went, I don't like February there. Let's put February between January and March. Because that's the kind of thing that people could do in the past, is just decide.
This is hilarious.
That I don't like this month here. It's not there anymore. February now lives just after January.
We've moved it.
Yeah,
sorry.
Surprise.
Deal with it.
Exactly.
Have you ever seen the wonderful, wonderful photographs from, I think it's Ghana, where probably while Ghana was still under British colonial rule, although I might be mistaken about that, where the decision was taken to change the side of the road that everybody drove on. But there wasn't really much of a public information campaign about it. So basically some people got the memo and some people didn't.
Yeah. I've seen a photo like
that
from Stockholm.
Like, okay, it's like, it's Tuesday. Tuesday's the day. Everybody has to drive on the other side of the road. And so the people who had heard that announcement were like, cool. And all the other people were like, what the f- what?
So what is
there are some
right
incredible
now
photographs of the, yeah, I mean, you can imagine the sort of chaos that ensued, but
yeah,
my God, it was chaotic. And
yeah,
this is the sort of thing I think about. Like, somebody says, right, February's no longer at the end of the year. We're going to put it second. Like, who let everybody know about this? Did,
yes,
did people care? Was it a pain? Did calendar makers lose their minds?
Yeah. Especially in the mid-5th century BC. Like,
what was going on?
Oh, I'm so glad it's March. No, it's not March yet. It's February. What? February's not for another 10 months. No, didn't you hear? It's now February. February is now. March is later now.
I hate the past.
Everything sucks. So that was the kind of thing. This is also the kind of thing that I think is contributing to the fact that the longer I do this, the less prescriptivist I get. Because, you know what? Who cares? Let's just move February. Why not? Everything's made up in the points.
You can't go getting snitty over apostrophes when some guy just went, you know that whole month at the end of the year? Fuck it, let's move it.
Let's just put it after January. Yeah, so it's like 452 is when January, February sort of settled in their place in the calendar.
That's hilarious.
Now, I know how much you hate sidebars. So if you want to pass on the little sidebar rabbit hole that I dove down to look up what the Germanic calendar was like before everyone kind of adopted the Julian calendar, we can skip it or we can just dive in.
Sorry. So what you're basically saying to me is, let's ignore the Vikings for a minute.
That's never a good idea. Right, okay.
You're losing your mind.
So
tell me about the Vikings.
So the Germanic peoples obviously used a different calendar from the Romans because that's how things worked before everyone decided that everyone in the world has to be the same. And so I'm taking this, I should say I'm pulling this. There's a couple different sources for this, but the primary one was a 2015 mental floss article by the incomparable Paul Anthony Jones, who is also Haggard Hawks on Twitter, which I'm sure everyone listening to the sound of my voice right now already follows on Twitter. But if not, you should.
Yeah. If not, you absolutely should. It's a great site.
And this is called The Month-by-Month Guide to the Anglo-Saxon Calendar. I'll have a link in the show notes and everything else. But anyway, so I looked this up because this got me thinking about what... Because they're so fluid, right? Let's put February here. Let's not have January, February at all. Calendars were, and everything else, was a lot more fluid in ye olden times. And so I was like, well, what are the Germans? What would have been the sort of native calendar of the Anglo-Saxons in England pre-Julian calendar? And here's what I found out, is that good old Bede is where this is all coming from. He's basically the only source for what the Germanic sort of timekeeping, because he decided to write a book on it in, like, I think it's 725.
Bede really was a dude, wasn't he?
He super was. And so he did this whole breakdown, and there's a bunch of others. If you should really dive down this rabbit hole, everybody, because there's some cool stuff. Like the fact that the old English word for fall is just harvest. Like, it's just harvest.
Nice.
That's what autumn was, and it's cool. So the name for the month that corresponds with January was basically just after Yule, or just after Christmas, was what the month was called. Eftera Geola, maybe? I don't know. February...
You had a valiant effort, Ryan.
I thought so.
I'll consider it a February. If it was right, great. And if not, we'll move it.
Yeah, well, exactly. February was Solmonath, which basically means, this is a really cool one, the month of mud cakes. And there seems to be some scholars are kind of like, okay, hold on, because it's from the old English word for mud, but it has something to do with cakes. And nobody's really sure whether Bede just screwed it up. And some people are like, no, this can't. Bede must have just got this wrong. People are like, maybe the cakes were just crap and they reminded people of mud because they were gritty and gross. And maybe they are literally just the month of mud cakes. But anyway.
Or maybe people made cakes out of mud and like threw them at each other in some bizarre Viking festival.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think ultimately the moral of this story is that February has always been garbage everywhere because it's the month of mud cakes. So there's that.
I'm now thinking about Mississippi mud cake, which is definitely not crap.
No, but you know what? I'm just going to go with it. I'm going to decide to retcon this and believe that the ancient Germanic tribes had access to chocolate and made delicious, delicious, delicious mud
delicious,
cakes.
Delicious, delicious mud cakes. Yeah.
March was Hrethmonath, which is named after a pagan fertility goddess, Hretha. April was interesting because it was Eostremonath, which is named after the pagan deity that people basically... E-O-S-T-R-E. Eostre, maybe? Estre? Anyways, the thought to be the goddess of dawn and fertility, etc., supposedly at a festival around the spring equinox, and a lot of people say that this is kind of...
Easter.
Yeah, one of the things that got sort of brought into the Christian tradition of Easter.
This goddess is in American Gods.
This is in... Yeah, she's featured in American Gods. Now, interestingly, there is no other source anywhere for the existence of this deity other than Bede in this particular work. In this particular context.
Cool.
So that's weird. And so that, like, there's a lot of questions that come up. The OED, as Paul is citing it in this article, points out that it would be weird for Bede, who was writing in a Christendom context, to invent a pagan deity that he would then attribute part of the Easter tradition to. So that would be a bizarre thing for someone to do.
Yeah.
But just the fact is that there is, like, literally this explanation for the month of April in the Germanic calendar is the only source for the existence of this pagan deity.
It's really revealing of how little we know about the past, isn't it?
It totally is. Yeah, 100%.
You know, like, obviously someone interpreted Bede's remarks on this to say, all right, okay, well, this means this, 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 and this, and Easter, and so on and so forth, and da 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 da, and that whole story has grown up around maybe, could have been, perhaps, that no one has any way to prove.
Yeah.
I was reading the other week that it was probably a Twitter thing, QI or one of those sorts of places, but it was the factoid was that there are no other contemporary reports that Marco Polo ever went to China. And some people believe that he actually made it up based on reports of Persian travellers and that he never, ever went there. There are no other records bar him saying, hey, dudes, I went to China and this is what happened.
Yeah. This is, it's crazy how little there actually is. And even stuff like that that everyone kind of, quote, everybody knows.
Yeah,
like Roman history.
Except it's true.
Like Roman history comes from, there's buildings. We knew the Romans were there. But you actually look at the sources, and there's like a handful of sources that have survived, and then there's other sources that are referencing older sources that haven't survived. But it's very piecemeal, you know? Like it's
history is pretty damn sketchy.
History is sketchy. That's the thing. Oh, another total sidebar. One of my favorite things about history being super sketchy is, have you heard the theory that we are actually right now living in the 17th century?
Oh, now this vaguely rings a bell, but I don't recall how this has come about.
So the idea of this, and anyway, I don't need to preface this with anything. The idea is that at some point in the, quote, Middle Ages or Dark Ages, there was basically someone made a typo and everyone just started thinking that they were then, like the historical record got fudged and someone missed a couple hundred years because there was like an important dating document or something like that was just dated wrong, and someone put a 9 instead of a 7, and we leapt ahead 200 years but didn't.
So this explains the existence of the Dark Ages.
Because
is that the theory?
Those didn't happen, and we have been actually living our all of our collective clocks have been about 250-300 years fast. Which
this
I love.
This is making my brain hurt in ways I cannot explain to you.
It's the temporal version of that whole thing, that kind of, I don't know, vaguely pseudo deep thought experiment of like, what do you see when you see the color blue? Is it really blue, or do you just call it blue? What do we mean by that? What does anyone mean by anything?
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
Please stop.
Because it's my favorite because it's irrelevant, and maybe it is. Sure, why not?
There's
Who
no
cares?
Way to prove it, and it solves nothing and contributes nothing, but it's also super interesting to think about.
Yeah, it's awesome. Anyway, we're only in April, so we should crack on. So May, in the Germanic calendar, was actually the month of 3 milkings. And I guess the idea was that livestock were so well fed on spring grass and such that they could be milked 3 times a day. So they called the month that. June and July were a collective, kind of like January and February were in the ancient Roman calendar. So they were just litha, meaning mild or gentle in Old English. And if they needed to differentiate, they basically just used kind of early or before mild and after or late mild to differentiate June and July. And apparently this is where they shoved like a leap month if they realized that it was getting super cold and maybe they were a month off in their calendar. And it would just be called third mild.
So that's great.
June and July were kind
I feel
of
like, this. Jim, I feel like we need an extra month this year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just
let's go for it.
Let's shove it in the mild time of year because we like that better. Nobody needs an extra month of mud cakes.
I mean, we're not going to like just move a whole month completely out of place. We're not Romans.
That would be madness. August was plant month. September was holy month, Heilig Monat. October was interesting. It was winter phileth, winter full moon. And Bede says that the idea here is that winter started on the first full moon of October. That was just how they marked the beginning of the season of winter. And so that's why winter full moon is the name of October. November's pretty great. It's Blutmonath, the month of blood sacrifices. So that's fun.
Of course.
And I guess
a minute ago when you said, let's not talk about the Vikings. And I said, shut up, Ryan. Tell me about the Vikings.
Yeah. This one, there doesn't seem to be a consensus as to why this was called this, but possible explanations would be that if people had weak or sick or just old livestock that were unlikely to survive the winter, they would basically just kill them either for food supplies to store over the winter when it could be sort of frozen by just being left in places, or they were kind of blood sacrifices to, like, please don't let this winter suck as hard as the other winter where everyone died type of ideas.
Yeah, that makes sense. Have you seen, I'm just thinking, we've either had a conversation about this before or we haven't, but there is a totally wonderful TV show called Norsemen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know Norsemen?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it starts with, like, the old men who are supposed to jump off the cliff.
Yeah.
But they don't really want to do it. So I'm thinking that the month of blood sacrifices, when it comes to Vikings, could have meant absolutely anything.
It could have meant anything.
Yeah.
What a bunch of nuts.
awesome and then, nuts.
Awesome. And then December was just, looping back to January, it was just Eira Geula before Yule. So pre-Christmas, after Christmas were December, January. And then, it all went round again.
Crazy shit in between. Wow.
So those are the Germanic months. But back to Janus for a little bit to wrap up. So Janus being the god of doorways, passages, transitions, gates, all that stuff. This is where we get the word janitor as well.
Ah, okay. Well, that has never occurred to me.
Yeah, because originally janitor was like a school doorman or usher, mm-hmm. and then became a custodian or caretaker, or, you know, someone who maintained in the cleanliness and operation of a, usually specifically a school, I think, but a building, anyway, an institution. Those were janitors, but named for the same. So that's where that J-A-N comes from, is the same as January and Janus as a doorway doorkeeper guy.
Cool.
And this one was kind of cool. Rio de Janeiro. This is called Rio de Janeiro because Amerigo Vespucci discovered it on January 1st, 1502. Hmm. And it's literally just the January River because he thought the bay he was looking at was a river estuary. And so he was just like, hey, it's January 1st today. Look at that neat thing. It's the River January.
Yeah. Wow.
So the J-A-N so, in De Janeiro.
It's just so do you have a flag, isn't it?
It's such a do you have a flag moment. Yep. I found it. It's January. It's the River January. Psst, Vespucci. It's not a river. Shut up.
Dude, do you have a flag?
They're going to name all this after me, sucker. Don't you question me. So, yeah.
Wow.
So Rio de Janeiro and January and janitors and the stupid winter months that don't matter anymore anyway. And, yeah, doorways, gateways, transitions, January.
And that's it for another episode of Lexitecture. To get in touch with us about something you heard this episode, you can email us at words@lexitecture.com. You can also follow along and talk to us at Lexitecture on Facebook and Twitter, and at Lexitecture Podcast on Instagram. For back episodes and the occasional blog post, visit us at lexitecture.com. Thanks very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.